We will now call the... All right. You guys are usually 5 minutes early. It's been hard because the each committee these days goes over a little bit and crouches on the next committee. It can be a little hard. Good to go now? All right. We'll officially call the meeting to order, the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. Welcome, everyone. Representative Abler may be back later. He's in another committee at this time, testifying, presenting a bill. Howes is here. Okay. Representative Howes is here, so if you want to get ready for the bill. Just some general information to the committee members and audience. We will take action on Representative Howes' bill today and Representative Schomacher's and Gout's. We'll be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and so we'll have plenty of time for public testimony and committee discussion, not just today, but when the bill is brought back from being laid over and presented as a whole bill. All right, and testifying guidelines were provided to all those who requested time on the agenda, and we'll help make sure that everybody is given a fair opportunity to testify and all of that. So with that... And we now have a quorum, so we can officially call the meeting to order with a quorum, and also let's take care of the minutes while we have them here.
So moved, Madam Chair.
And the minutes have been moved. Representative Hamilton, thank you. Any discussion? Seeing none, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. Thank you very much, members. Okay, we are ready to go. Representative Howes, please present your bill.
Could you move?
Would you like me to move it?
Bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Howes. I will move House File 2676 to be recommended to pass and to be referred to the General Register. All right.
Okay, Madam Chair and members, I'll be as brief as I can, and if you have questions, I have somebody here that can answer them. Basically, in current law, we all already have eligibility grants for area pregnancy centers, and that was established in 2005, and all we're doing in the bill is changing it to 2011 because there have been so many that have opened after 2005. There's one in Walker where I live, one in Park Rapids just outside of my district. I know personally the one in Walker is doing an awesome job of simply giving women an alternative to an abortion and help them actually plan themselves through the pregnancy and plan what happens after the child is born. They are doing an awesome job, and I actually do give them a little bit of money every month to help them on their course, and this would also help them a great deal, and we'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Howes. You have a testifier with you today, or just ready
for
questions?
Well, I want to help you. If there are no questions and you just want to send it to the General Register, that would be awesome, but if you have any tough questions, she's here to help.
Okay, well, seeing no questions at this time, Representative Howes, I renew my motion that House File 2676 be recommended to pass and that it be moved to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Howes, you are on your way. All right, our next bill on the agenda is Representative Schomacher, House File 1985.
I hear that from a lot of people.
Representative Schomacher, you have a testifier today, Mr. Gustafson. Is that right?
Right.
Or is that a possibility?
That's a possibility.
All right. Okay, and would you like to make a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I will move that House File 1985 be recommended to pass and move to the Ways and Means Committee.
Okay, thank you very much, Representative Schomacher. Please proceed and present your bill.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 1985 modifies the requirements on background checks at licensed facilities. Currently, an employee who returns to a position after 45 days or longer is required to have another background study issued. This bill lengthens the 45-day threshold to 180 days. The lengthening of this time period before another study is conducted is intended to help new mothers returning to the workforce after maternity leave, college students wanting to work during school breaks like Thanksgiving or the winter holiday, and preschool employees who are not employed during summer months. The fiscal note estimates about 1,500 studies were performed last year due to the 45-day period, and that this bill would reduce that number to 500. There is no direct fiscal impact to the state of this because there's a $20 fee that is assessed to each background check, and that's just to cover the cost of the study. The 180 days established is a thorough window to cover the concerns listed above, and this bill came to my attention through a human resource director at a nursing home in my district. She shared concerns because she is already required to report anything that would remove an employee's good standing, and the groups most likely to be impacted for her were employees on maternity leave and college students on break. So with that, I thank you, and we'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Schumacher. Members, any questions? All right, I see no questions. Your representative? All right, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering if the department has any. I haven't heard anything from my county about this, or I just wonder if there's, you know, anybody from the agency that could talk about this.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Is there anybody here from the department that might like to address this? Or Representative Schumacher, maybe you have a comment in regards to the department.
Madam Chair, I have spoken to the department on this. They had one concern that we addressed in the HHS Reform Committee as it deals with people who are in the parole program and having those being reported to the department as well, so that anyone who participates in breaking the law gets reported.
Okay, thank you, Representative Schumacher. And I've been informed that all the folks that might otherwise be here are up in civil law.
Oh.
But since Representative Schumacher has discussed this with them, does that address your... Representative Liebling, did you have something else?
Well, not really, Madam Chair. Thank you for that. I guess if they had a problem, they'd be here. And I guess I'm understanding from Representative Schumacher that things have kind of been worked out and there's peace in the valley on this. So, right?
That is correct.
Yeah,
yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Liebling, for that. Anybody else? All right. Seeing then, we'll proceed to a vote. House File 1985, Representative Schumacher renews his motion to pass House File 1985 and that it be referred to Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Schumacher, your bill is on its way.
Thank you.
To Ways and Means. I'll see you there. Okay. The next two bills that we have on the agenda would be held over for possible inclusion to let you know ahead of time so that if you... have your questions or any other issues to work on here, but it will be coming back to this committee again in the omnibus bill. Representative Dowd, welcome to the committee, and I for move for a possible inclusion, House File 2081. Representative Dowd, welcome, and when you're ready, please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I also do have an amendment that I would like someone to offer just to get the bill in the shape that we'd like it in.
Okay, Representative Dowd, I will move the 2081A3 amendment. Would you like to go ahead and discuss your amendment or
certainly, I can kind of explain what we're doing here. Originally, the bill had been drafted with language that required a background check and then disqualified somebody who had a drug offense in the previous 10 years from receiving the benefits. And what we've done here is we've changed it to, and actually we did make one change in the other committee, and then the change was not done properly. So this is just a fix to get it in the shape that we want it in.
Okay.
But the way that it would work now is we would still, for people who have drug offenses in the previous 10 years, we would move them to vendor pay. So rather than the cash benefit where they can take cash out of the ATM machine, they would need to have the department pay those vendors directly with the benefit, and then there is no background check anymore. So that's okay. What this amendment does.
Okay, Representative Dowd's amendment, A3 amendment. We'll proceed to a vote and just go ahead and place this on so we have it in the shape the author would like. All those in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the A3 amendment is adopted. Representative Dowd, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 2081, as amended here, does a few things. This started out as a discussion based on the legislation that we passed last session regarding the prohibition of using the benefits or the EBT card to purchase alcohol and tobacco. There was some language that basically was contradictory in the statute. The language we passed last year had said that it was a kind of a one strike and you're out, and other places in statute was a three strikes and you're out. And then also there was some things about the EBT card. Originally we thought that you could not, that if we issued or printed the name on the card, that we had to issue a second card. And since we found out, as long as there's no other user, if it's just one user in the household, that it can still be issued. We can just issue one card and pay the federal SNAP benefits and the state benefits on the same card. The only restriction there is under the federal benefits. If we pay the SNAP benefits, that card needs to be used by other members of the household. So, and they had a restriction about putting the name on the card. So in the instance where there's just one member of the household that's using the card, we still can put the name of the card and it can be issued on the same card. So that's what the first section does there. The second section, I think, brings us back to that three strikes and you're out. The third section we added in this, actually in the HHS Policy Committee, basically states that EBT benefits on the EBT cards cannot be used at an ATM machine or at a vendor outside of Minnesota and the four surrounding states. And then that section four is another section that deals with the alcohol tobacco stuff and the three strikes that we talked about earlier. So that basically is House File 2081.
Thank you, Representative Dowd. Members? All right. Representative Loeffler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Dowd, I wasn't on the policy committee, so I didn't get to hear the bill as much as maybe other members have. But in your overview, you talked about people going on to vendor pay. And I'm wondering to which degree you've actually considered the practical ramifications of that. For example, there are not EBT readers on the bus system in the metropolitan area. If you were to arrange for childcare so you could get to a medical appointment, maybe you're going through CD treatment, maybe you're dealing with some issues. Most childcare providers will not take a vendor pay situation, and I think that may thwart achievement of some of the goals that we have for families that may have run into issues. And I wonder if you could address that and tell me how you think those families could resolve that.
Representative Dowd.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Loeffler. I'm not sure that any of those are obstacles that can't be overcome. The daycare providers, I'm certain that they could be vendor paid. And possibly somebody from the department could talk about whether, bus tokens or those kinds of things could be purchased and put on, I don't know what the process is there for purchasing those, but I'm sure that could also be worked out. And I don't know if somebody from the department would like to talk about that. I know they do vendor pay in certain circumstances now.
Representative Dowd, do they not also have Metro Passes where a lot of people are frequent users of the bus? They are able to do this with a Metro Pass, and at which point they would be able to use that, correct?
Yeah, that's my understanding, Madam Chair. Thank you.
All right. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Since we're enacting law, I think it shouldn't be just speculation about whether or not we can overcome these obstacles, but we should actually know it. My understanding of MetroPass is you have to buy a fairly large amount, which on our small grants don't always work if you just are going to make, several bus trips in a month. Oftentimes they're provided through an employer payroll deduction, which wouldn't apply in this situation, laundromats. I mean, there's all kinds of things that are typically used by people on these programs in low-income neighborhoods because they don't have washing machines and dryers and those sorts of things in the places that they're living. So I just really think we need to make sure that this is not going to be creating undue hardship in achieving the goals that we want, which is successful families, successful individuals, and who are able to meet their basic needs.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. My question is, as I understand it, though, there's also cash benefits and others that go along as well. This is not their only sole source of income. Is that correct? To your understanding, this is not their sole source of income? Okay. We have a testifier.
Okay, Madam Chair, let's hear from the testifier.
Right.
I think they can clarify it.
Yep.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jane DeLage, and I work for the Department of Human Services with the MPIP program. I do believe that there are complications that are caused by vendor paying the grants that we have to deal with currently, and I think we may have need to talk to some of the counties more specifically about how they do handle that, but we do vendor pay for drug felons now that are identified, though the numbers are very small. I think it's a workload issue as well, but my understanding, and I would like to check this out with more of the counties, is that in some cases they have to issue a voucher or a check for some things that the vendor won't accept a vendor payment. They may have to issue checks, so that would create additional work for the counties. And you're right, with things like bus tokens and things like that, that can be an additional burden, and I'm not sure how that would be handled in terms of doing the laundry, going to the bus, having to have some cash available. But there are some vendor payments being done now. So if there's anyone in the county who would want to address that, otherwise I can get back to the committee after talking more with some of the counties.
Thank you, Ms. DeLage. Representative Loeffler?
Thank you. I look forward to hearing from counties before this is before
okay.
us finally.
All right.
If you feel you need
the chairman is back.
Is there a list or? Okay. Representative Doubt.
Mm-hmm.
So the bill is then held over? Mm-hmm. Is that right? Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I apologize. I probably should have had Ms. Pinelli speak about the amendment. I think what I'm doing is mixing up my two bills. The vendor pay stuff and the drug conviction stuff is in the other bill, the next one that we'll talk about. So it's the next one that's coming up. So it's not in this House File 2081. So my apologies.
Okay, so do you want it held over to move to the next bill then? Or do you want to hear from Ms. Pinelli?
No, I think we're okay. If there's further questions about this bill, I'm certainly happy to take those. But
sorry, I'm coming in cold.
Yeah, I have a question.
Any other questions? Representative Fritz. Hi.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to the author, I just wanted to make clear that the amendment that was just put on is three strikes and you're out. It isn't you buy the cigarettes and three times and then you're permanently off. Is that correct?
Representative Dowd.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and Representative, it's my understanding that it is a three strikes and you're out. It's consistent with what we currently have in statute, and maybe Ms. Pinelli can talk about how that actually works more in depth, but I believe it's the first violation is 1 year off the program, second violation 2 years off, third time, and you're off for good.
Ms. Pinelli, do you want to just...
She did. Thank you.
You're nodding your head, but why don't you just say something? Okay.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Doubt described that correctly.
Thank you. Other questions from members? Okay, so we can hold this over then for possible inclusion. So I'll move House Bill 2080 for possible inclusion. And do you have amendments to that?
I do, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I would like to have the A4 amendment moved, if someone could do that, just to get the bill in the shape that we'd like it in.
Well, I'll move the A4 amendment. Do you want to describe it? This has been heard elsewhere, so you should describe it first.
certainly. And maybe Ms. Pinelli can help walk me through the details of the fine details of what this one does as well.
Ms. Pinelli, please.
Mr. Chair, members, the A4 amendment, lines 1.2 to 1.9 deal with the section that is concerning convicted drug offenders, and it basically just refers back to current law for most of it. I think the only change that remains is doing a 10-year look back at drug offenses rather than going back to July 1st of 1997. On the amendment A4, lines 1.10 through 1.19 adds a new subdivision to the MFIP chapter talking about vendor payment and what happens if somebody is having their benefits vendor paid and they're living in a building that's deemed uninhabitable. And then on the A4 amendment, lines 1.20 to 1.25 modifies the MFIP lifetime limit for benefits. Currently what's in the bill for new people coming onto the program, the lifetime limit would go from 60 months down to 36 months, and this changes it so that the limit would be 36 consecutive months, or if a person received no more than 12 consecutive months of assistance followed by at least 6 months of no assistance, they could come on and off the program and continue to have that 60-month time limit.
Thank you. Is that clear to members? Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's vote on that then. All in favor of the A4 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Amendment's adopted. Representative Dowd, is that all the amendments you have?
That's it.
Can you, this has been a moving target. And so do you have kind of a list of what the salient summary points are? I know that Ms. Pinelli read the amendment to us, but I think it's helpful for people to know what's not in the bill anymore and what is. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is the last bill, and we're going to move to testimony. So I want people to know to testify about the right thing. So maybe as your presentation, you could kind of just itemize the five or so key elements of the bill in a short fashion, which would be fine.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I will try to do that. As you mentioned, it's been a little bit confusing because it has been somewhat of a moving target. So I don't have a list here, but I'll just quickly page through the bill and kind of run through that as best I can. Lines 1.4 to 1.14 to 1.17 is the same language that was in the last bill about limiting the EBT use to Minnesota and the four surrounding states.
And that's just the cash portion, not the food portion.
Correct. Yep. And just to be clear, Mr. Chairman and members, that's for this entire bill. We're just dealing with the Minnesota benefits that are on this card, the cash portion. We're not really allowed to do anything with the SNAP benefit, the federal portion of the card. So this is just the Minnesota benefit.
That's an important point.
Yeah.
So, okay. And what's the next part?
We have, as the amendment mentioned, the lifetime limit on the bill originally was taking the lifetime limit from 60 months down to 36 months. We've now adjusted that with the amendment so that the bill basically, you could still do 60 months, but you have to do 12 months on, 6 months off to get the 60 months. If you use it consecutively, it's a lifetime limit of 36 months. So. That's what the new language does. And my intent was to have a second level to that, and I'm not sure that showed up in the drafting. I'm catching it now as I'm reading through the language. My intent was that if someone stayed on for 12 months and decided at the end of that period to continue for another consecutive 12 months, that they would then forfeit 12 months off the end. So if they skipped that first six-month window. Likewise, if they skipped, so then their lifetime limit would come down to 48 months. And if they skipped the second window, they'd lose another 12 months off the end. So that was my intent, and I'm not sure that's not exactly what was drafted. So I think we're missing that
held over, so we can
middle window.
Hopefully people can testify to your
okay,
intent.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So
we can clean that up later.
Mm-hmm. Also in here is the looking back 10 years on the drug convictions and moving those people to vendor pay that we talked about with the previous bill. And then did we remove the 100%? No, that's still in the bill? Okay.
And Mr. Representative Dowd, the drug conviction, it's felony drug conviction, which
correct.
Is different than a simple possession or some small amount. These are significant drug crimes.
Correct.
And they're to be self-reported anyway, as I understand. And if they were self-reported, they would have some consequences anyway. So.
And then we do still have the provision in that a receiver would exit the program at 100% of the federal poverty level instead of the 115 that's currently in statute. So that's still in the bill as well. And I think that covers it. Oh, I apologize, Mr. Chairman. There's also a section in here about sanctions. Currently, I think there's 7 sanctions allowed before somebody is kicked off of the program, and we've taken that down to 3 sanctions.
All right, thank you. Because and there's no, so it's not reduced to 10% or the other percentage. It's just 3, and then you're done without the reductions in the percentages. Is that right?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Pinelli, you're looking at me kind of funny. Is that right, or is that did I say it wrong?
Mr. Chair and members, the language about what happens for a second section of noncompliance doesn't change. So the assistance unit's shelter costs would be vendor paid up to the amount of the cash portion of the MFIP grant, and then the residual amount after the vendor payment is reduced by 30%, I believe.
Oh, okay. So there was a partial reduction on the third. Okay. Is that correct? Okay. Is that the highlights?
I believe so, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate your patience in letting us walk through that with assistance of House Research. This has really been a moving target, and the reason that it has been is I've had many people come to me and talk to me about concerns with the bill, legal aid and many other concerned organizations, and I will say that everybody has been very good to work with, and we've been very open to talking about all of those suggestions and adopting changes that will make this a better piece of legislation. So thank you.
And I see some considerable changes from the last time I heard this bill, so in the Reform Committee. So, Representative Liebling. So we'll take a few member questions, and then we'll move to testimony when members are understand the bill. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I just have a question about what you just went through, but I just want to say I think it would be very hard to make this a good piece of legislation. But anyway, my question has to do with the felony drug conviction disqualification thing, and as I'm reading the language here, it says an individual who has been convicted of a drug offense. It doesn't say anything about a felony. Am I wrong in that? Where does it say that it has to be a felony drug offense?
Representative Dowd.
Maybe House Research can answer that one.
That was your intention? That was our intention.
The intention is felony.
If we need an oral amendment to clarify that, this would be, I would call that in very much order, so if that's your intent. So maybe we can come back to that. And Ms. Pinelli, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members, there's language in current law in the bill. It's on page 4, lines 10 through 15, that defines what a drug offense is, and I believe the statutes that are listed there are the felony offenses.
Oh.
That's the way I understood it.
Representative Liebling, is that good for now? We can come back to that question if you want.
Well, Mr. Chair, as I'm just looking at the language that Ms. Pinelli just pointed us to, that has this after July 1st, 1997 in it. I don't know if, you know, that's still a problem. I mean, I'm not going to get involved with fixing Representative Dowd's bill because I don't think it's fixable, frankly. But I just want to point out that, you know, to the extent that it's a moving target, somebody should shoot it.
Thank you. I take that as a comment, not a question. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Dowd. We deal with like really practical issues in people's lives, and they're living on the edge on very limited money. And you know, I wish you'd put the time and energy into this that I think it really needs, because it does feel like it's not ready for serious consideration. For example, your amendment talks about how to deal with vendor payment if there's an uninhabitable building. Last year at the end of session, a tornado ripped through North Minneapolis. That's an area that has a lot of low-income people. It might be that a landlord who owned multiple buildings had one of them destroyed, or the roof was ripped off, or something or other, and so it would be rendered uninhabitable. But as your language fits, says this, then that landlord is prohibited, as I understand it, from receiving vendor pay, even if they have other buildings that are in fine condition. And so you're going to throw a bunch of families potentially out in the street because the landlord can't accept vendor pay because one of his buildings was destroyed. And, I mean, I just think we need to think through sort of these things. And, you know, your notice, we have in current statute a notice requirement that's on page 4 that tells people, you know, like what the rules of the game are. But you're changing the rules of the game, and I don't see the notice requirements here that tell them, you know, we've got this new deal that's, you know, 12 months on, 6 months off, this, that, the other thing. And, you know, if we're going to, you know, tell people who are perhaps through no loss of their own, you know, to be end up having to apply for government assistance. They've been unemployed and they don't qualify for unemployment compensation or whatever. We ought to at least just be upfront about what the rules of the revised program are. And so, I mean, there's just lots of little things like this through the drafting that I think we're used to seeing in a more polished manner before here. And I'm really concerned that we're going to end up with unintended consequences and some real serious issues in people's lives that were just because of sloppy drafting and not thinking through step by step what does this mean.
Representative Loeffler, it's being held over here, and so if you just, those opportunities will remain through this process. Ms. Webster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, yeah. And Representative Loeffler. I should take the heat for the sloppy drafting on the vendor payment. With that, and I'm sorry, my name is Jessica Webster. I'm with Legal Aid, and we still are opposed to House File 2080 for a number of reasons, but Representative Dowd was gracious enough to talk to me about this particular vendor payment issue, and it relates, for us, it relates to slumlords. We're really concerned right now that if someone's in a slumlord situation, they don't have access to the rent escrow remedy through the court system. So we tried to come up with a remedy where the county could withhold a payment from a slumlord and a person would still, you know, would still have access to their benefits and still have some kind of remedy. So that's what this particular fix is, and this is something that Legal Aid asked Representative Dodd for. Thank you.
Representative Loeffler, do you want to?
Thank you. Those are just two examples. I think there's others, and my broader comment was this has not been thought through to the degree that I think we should.
Fair enough. Other member, Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I, too, have concerns about the housing area. You know, I have slum landlords, too, I'm ashamed to admit, down in my beautiful counties. But and people, families live there. It's their the roof over their head, so to speak. So I have concerns with that. But I also wanted to ask Representative Dowd, you said that you have been meeting with other groups, and I'm happy to hear that. And in your packet, there is a letter from the Archdiocese, the Minnesota Catholic Conference, and I think that you probably, I hope that you have met with them. And they oppose this bill, adamantly oppose this bill, and I hope that I did have a copy put in all of your packets today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And also, I just wanted, you know, to go back to the lowering the MFIP level to 100%. And you know, you're throwing children off of assistance and food and their home. We have enough homelessness right now. Upstairs in 500 South, there's a meeting talking about foreclosures and what we can do to help those people. And I have, you know, tons of people living in not the best situations throughout my district. And I'm very concerned that by lowering this, you know, it's I also am concerned because I look at the folks here that I serve with on both sides of the aisle, and we serve on the Ladder Out of Poverty Task Force, trying to get people out of poverty and up and out into better living conditions. And this, to me, harms that effort. So I just wanted to make that point, and I hope that you do take a look at this.
Representative Gottwell.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to get into a big protracted debate here, but we've been hearing from one side, and Representative Dowd, maybe you can answer this for me. Mr. Chair and Representative Dowd, is the intent of this bill to try to close loopholes leading to inappropriate use of EBT? Now, I'm Roman Catholic. A lot of people know that. I wore the ashes on my forehead on Ash Wednesday. Appreciate the perspectives of the Catholic Church, and I understand their concern for the poor. I share it. That's part of why I understand what Representative Dowd, I think, is trying to do. Now, we can debate whether or not that's being accomplished in this legislation, but the idea of preserving EBT resources for the purposes of helping people in need is a legitimate and laudable goal that should be supported by everybody in the state. Now, if this bill doesn't do it or doesn't do it in the right way, I think we can talk about that. But I've been listening to this debate long enough where we have castigated people based on intent, something we don't do here in this legislature, we're not supposed to do, impugning intent. But Representative Dell, can you speak to that? Is that what you're intending to do with this bill, even if we can debate whether or not it accomplishes that or accomplishes it appropriately?
Representative Dell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Gottwald. I think you said it very well. That really is the intent here. Obviously these resources are needed by families and maybe more so now than ever before. And you know what we're aiming to do here is protect those resources for people that really need them, and we want to help these people. That's what these programs are designed to do, is help these people through a tough time and get themselves to a sustainable point in their life. So there certainly isn't ill intent here, and I appreciate your comments, and I very much agree with you. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, just briefly in follow-up, I know there are people here who don't believe that, who don't believe that that's the intent, but I will tell you that is the reason I understand this bill is here. That is the reason I understand. I've talked with Representative Dowd about this bill, and it's the reason my name is attached to some of this legislation. It is not to hurt, penalize poor people or anything else. It's that we know we have limited resources. We've just come out of a very difficult economic time. And I can tell you there are people out there who need help who probably are upset, genuinely upset, and should be, that money is going for things that aren't essential, that money might be being used for things like tobacco or alcohol. And like I said, I think we can have a reasonable conversation. Representative Dowd has clearly shown a desire to work with people on this. But that's the reason this legislation is here, and to suggest anything else I think is just inappropriate.
Representative Liebling, and then McDonald, then we'll move to testimony, I think.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and, you know, I don't actually hear a lot of motives being questioned. I think we're saying the bill is, in my view, a very bad and punitive bill, no matter what Representative Dowd's intent is here. And obviously the Catholic Church agrees with me, and it's good to be on that side once, at least.
Once?
But anyway, I did have a question about this. You know, if the intent here is to help and preserve resources and all that, and, you know, we all do agree on that, and there are some other bills going through, and the administration has for the first time established an Office of the Inspector General inside DHS, mm-hmm. which is pulling together all of the efforts to make sure there's no fraud and all of that. So obviously the Dayton administration has taken that very seriously. But what this bill does is go a lot further than that. And now in the amendment, we have this change from the 36-month lifetime limit, which, frankly, cutting people off at 36 months, I don't know how that says that. I guess after 36 months, no matter what your situation, you don't need it anymore. I guess those are resources on Representative Gottwald, under your formulation, those are resources going to people who don't really need them after 36 months. But I want to ask Representative Dowd, he's made this change now, this thing about the 12 months and then 6 months receiving no assistance and so on. And I wanted to ask, what is the data that's based on? The data. what data do you have that shows that that's going to get people to be less dependent, or that people who need more than 12 months of assistance are somehow less diligent in their efforts to pull themselves up? What data is that based on? Where are those numbers coming from? And how many people would this affect in Minnesota?
Representative Dowd.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative. We actually looked at data about the average consecutive time period that people are on the program, and I apologize, I don't have those numbers right here in front of me, and maybe the department can recall them better than I can, but we took a look at the average and over the lifetime how often people are going off and coming on the program, and I don't remember the numbers right off the top of my head about how many people this would affect, but you know, the average is not 60 months. The average time that somebody's on these programs is 24 months, so it's far less than the 60-month lifetime limit. So, you know, as far as the number of people, I don't have that right in front of me. So maybe, I don't know if the department can answer that one for you.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Dowd, so there's a 24-month average use, but under law you can have a lifetime ability to go back on up to 60 months over your lifetime. Okay, and the average is 24. So basically, I wonder if this isn't just another solving a problem that doesn't exist. That's what I see this doing. There is no problem. If it's a 24-month average, you know, an average hides the extremes. Some people obviously stay on much longer, but not more than 60 months, and some people are going to be getting off really soon. So by imposing on everybody basically a 12-month sort of soft limit, I don't know what you're accomplishing here. That's my question. What problem are you solving then by doing this, by playing around with the limits on this?
Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative. You know, obviously what I'm trying to achieve here is people who are abusing the system and staying on the system that don't need to be on it. And I know that there are people that desperately need these programs and these services, and that's really what we're trying to protect here. And you know, conversely, I would ask you, if there isn't a problem, then why is it a problem to put this legislation in? Because what we are going to tag is the people who are on the program for 60 months taking advantage of the program.
Representative Liebling?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I'd like the department to come down again and explain to us, you know, this idea that there are people who don't need to be on the program, who are on it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know where that comes from, other than, you know, if you want to say de facto that if you're on it for more than 12 months, you don't need to be. I mean, that's just a totally arbitrary thing, especially in this economy where people can't get jobs. You know, I don't think it's you're the guy with the bill. I don't think I have to justify current law, but I would like the department to come down and explain just how they determine whether somebody needs to be on the program and what it means to not need to be, because right now, if you're over 115% of poverty, you're off anyway. So I don't know what you mean by people being on who don't need to be, unless you're just saying after 12 months you don't need to be.
The department is Ms. DeLage. Welcome to the committee. Maybe you can offer some.
My name is Jane DeLage, and I am with the Department of Human Services. I work with the MFIP program. If I understand the question correctly, the question is who's on the program, and whether anyone who's not does not need the program is on the program. You know, we do have extensive eligibility criteria, and all of those families who continue on the program have to continue to meet the eligibility criteria. There are asset limits, there are income limits. So folks who are on the program must continue to meet work requirements, or they can be sanctioned off of the program. They have to meet eligibility requirements of income and assets. So I don't know if there's a further question related to that. People come on and off of the program, and so some may have accumulated more months over time. Yes, on average, between 2 and 3 years, people do go off, but there are families who continue to have needs or maybe are affected by a job loss and come back on the program. Does that answer your question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that's great. And one further piece of that. So just to be clear, can a person just decide they plain old don't want to do anything and sit home and eat bonbons and be on the program?
Who said that? Ms. DeLay.
Who said that?
Members of the committee, no. There are work requirements for our participants, and if they fail to meet the work requirements, they are sanctioned, and they're after this for the seventh month of non-compliance, they are sanctioned off the program. If you are once sanctioned off of the program, if you come back on in compliance, you don't have another 7 months. You have 1 month to comply. So no, people are required to meet work requirements. That's part of the federal TANF requirements as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I have two more, and then we're two more. We have McDonald and Lane, then we'll take testimony, and then we'll go back to the other people. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question for the author, Representative Dowd. It appears that this bill will put us in line with what our neighboring states have done in, one, taking good care of those who need help, not abandoning them, but doing the right thing, the poor and the elderly. They've done it successfully. So this bill just conforms Minnesota to that. We've modeled some of their best practices and brought it into our Minnesota so we can get rid of some areas that maybe need some help, that some folks are abusing it, perhaps. And we can't hide behind that. We humans make mistakes. We abuse all kinds of things. Rich, poor, big, tall, short, we all have mistakes, make mistakes. So I want the two questions for you, and then I'll be still because we have the other things. One, in our neighboring states, in the research, in our neighboring states that we model this program on, have the poor, as some have said in this room, in this table, have they been homeless, put out of their house? Have the children not been taken care of? And have the states completely abandoned their obligation to take care of the poor? That's my question one.
Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative. I don't know that I'm an expert in what's going on in all the other states. However, I have looked at some of the restrictions and some of the programs in other states and the benefits that they offer. And I think just generally we can all answer that we don't see an epidemic of that happening in any of the states surrounding us. So, to answer your question directly, some of what's in here is driven at kind of bringing our benefits in line with the states around us.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, then I just would like to say two things. One, I do have a question regarding the bill, a concern of mine, but I want to editorialize in this, and I think it's unfair that one would accuse another group of wanting to deliberately not help the poor and put them out in the street. I think that's a shame, and it doesn't help our good work that we're doing in Minnesota. I think that's very disingenuous and unfair. I would never accuse anyone of not deliberately wanting not help the poor and put someone out in the house. So those who do it, I don't appreciate it. I will never stoop to that level and accuse someone of wanting to deliberately put someone out of the house and make them poor. But I do have a concern with subsection 4, 212 to 213, where it says that a person who uses it for tobacco and alcohol can be permanently, and I hope I'm reading the amendment, permanently disqualified. Is that the amendment?
You're on 2081, McDonald. Do you want to revert to that question? So we're on 2080, but do you have the floor? Do you want to just Well, actually, it's just to make sure people understand the question. If you don't understand it, maybe somebody else doesn't either. But Representative Dowd, do you want to revert to 2080 and answer his question?
Certainly. What's going to happen there, and we covered that a little bit earlier, if somebody violates that, it's kind of a three strikes and you're out program. The first one, they'll disqualify from using the or qualifying for the benefits for a one-year period. On the second offense, it's a two-year period. And the third offense, they're disqualified permanently from the programs.
Representative McDonald.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, it is, because I spoke to you about that a couple weeks ago, and I appreciate that. That was your response. I think that the vendor, someone who's selling this, who's profiting from it, knowing it's against the law, and maybe it's not in the bill, maybe it is, I don't see it. Is there any penalty for the vendor, the store that knows it's against the law and sells it? Do they get any three strikes that they're out?
No. Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative. There is not, and we debated that, and originally when I brought that bill last year, there was some language like that. We ended up removing it, and there was a concern that, we didn't want to have an adversarial situation. Potentially, I'm not trying to be stereotypical, but I'll just draw a scenario here for you where you have maybe a 16-year-old clerk in a store having to say to somebody, no, I can't sell you these cigarettes, and it just becomes an uncomfortable adversarial situation. And so we opted not to do that. But ultimately, I believe that it's the end user's responsibility, and I think it's okay for us to hold those people responsible and accountable for that. We did print that right on the card now, so that'll be enacted into law, and it's my understanding from the department that the card stock that they have currently, they've already begun printing it on, but June 1st is when that law that we passed last year gets enacted, so it's going to say right on the card, you can't use this benefit for purchasing alcohol or tobacco products. So, but thank you for the question. And, also, I'd just like to follow up. Part of what, I had stated about the lifetime limit on the benefits, and I agree very much with your comments about nobody's trying to kick anybody off of programs here, but we're trying to give people a choice, and my idea was at the end of 12 months somebody could make a decision and have some ownership in the benefit themselves and say, I'm by staying on an additional 12 months, I can do that, but I'm giving something up. I'm making a decision to stay on. So what we're trying to do is provide some incentive to make a decision that, maybe I don't need to be on for the next 12 months, and there isn't just an automatic that we've given them some decision-making ability in that process. So that's that really was why I put that provision into the bill.
Thank you. Representative Lane, we actually are accumulating a list here. Can you give a short comment? I have like 20 witnesses that want to
I have a question, and then I have a letter from pastor in my district.
You can't read a letter right now, but there's 20 witnesses that want to testify, so I'm trying to take some member questions. It's been pretty fair on both sides. Do you want to ask a question? That would be appropriate.
Yes. My question is every single person on the Minnesota Family Investment Program have children?
Perhaps in a doubt.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Every single person that you're talking about here is caring not just for themselves but for children. Mm-hmm. So when you kick them off, you're kicking off their children too.
Representative Dowd, and actually the department could answer that question if we need some clarification. And then we're going to move to testimony.
And I also would say that my understanding is that it's about $535 a month for a family of three to pay for rent, transportation, clothing, shoes, school items, everything. I find that impossible, absolutely impossible. The food comes from the food program, but the $535 a month, I to this day cannot understand why anybody would want to stay there. They need to. They need help.
And Representative Pinelli, do you want to speak to that question, or do you know the answer? Just then we'll move to testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, in order to be eligible for the MFIT program, there has to be either a minor child in the household or a pregnant woman.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Dowd, you can stand aside. We're going to have a bunch of witnesses here. And we're going to take Ms. Kruger and Mr. Gustafson first from the counties. But I just want to, this has been a very, people don't agree on this topic, and I respect that. And the discussion has been very respectful and reasonable. The last hearing of this was not respectful and reasonable. And I just want to remind people of a law.
Mm-hmm. And we are a nation of laws. We're built on respect. But there is a crime. It's called disturbing legislature or intimidating a member. And it's a gross misdemeanor. And if you willfully disturb the legislature while it's in session or commit disorderly conduct, interrupting proceedings, or intimidate somebody, that's a gross misdemeanor. That is a bad one. Yes, you do not want to have one of those. And in my committees, no one's ever been anywhere close to that. I like it that way. Mm-hmm. We can have open hearings with lots of witnesses. No one is barred. Everybody gets their chance. They get their 2 minutes or 3 minutes or 4 minutes, whatever it is. They get the chance to say their piece. We listen carefully. People from both sides are listening. Because of the activities of the last time this was heard, security in the Capitol was very concerned. I don't know if you've noticed, we have a man, a trooper in the back, who's fully armed. It's his duty to protect you and us from each other. If you notice, some have stopped in from the hallway. And so we have no need to do anything silly today. So if you all, I'm not worried about the president, you guys, if the counties just simply behave better, we wouldn't need to have this kind of security. But members, I believe in an open process, good discussion, proper debate. And so when your time is up, please stop. You can say anything you want while you have your 2 minutes or your 4 minutes. The topic is, hopefully keep it to the points we're at. Please remember what changes have happened. And just understand how to make your committee, your testimony useful. If somebody already said that, like the last person before you, it doesn't help us to know you want to say the exact same thing. So at least use your own words to emphasize that. And then actually we learn. And the testimony benefits us and benefits the cause you believe in. So, and please not question the motives of the members. It's really a good rule. You can question our actions. You can question our good ideas or our bad ideas, ideas you don't agree with. Focus on the policy. And I think we'll have a good discussion with the next, 20 witnesses, and we'll get it done on time. Everybody can have their piece. So, Ms. Krueger and Mr. Gustafson, you have a And just so you know, the people who wanted to testify to both things got 4 minutes, and the people who testified to one thing got 2 minutes. So we have in front of us a person testifying to one thing and two things. So you have a few minutes. So I know you'll be prudent with your time, and welcome to the committee, and I'm glad you're here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Ruth Krueger. I'm the Employment and Economic Assistance Director for Dakota County, and I'm testifying for the Association of Minnesota Counties and MACSA, the County Social Services Directors. First of all, I want to start by saying thank you. The change I heard pretty clearly was that all the background checks, whether they're drug checks or background, would now be self-reported, and so we do not have to bring you all of the thousands and thousands of dollars that we were going to talk about, because we, too, as counties, are very concerned about what it costs to administer these programs. Chairman Abler has been very tolerant as the counties have come to him over and over again asking for simplification. So as I listen to on again, off again, 12 months, I'm thinking about my staff of financial workers trying to figure out who's on, who's off, how many times do people apply. You need to know that adds greatly to the cost of administering the programs. The reducing it to 100% of poverty also would increase the cost of administering the program because people are very fragile at that level. So they would go off and then they would come back on again, and that's an added cost. I've been with Dakota County since 1977, and so I applaud all of you for taking this seriously and looking at ways to make these programs more cost-effective. When I was working on my doctorate, I was able to do an internship in Washington, D.C., during the time when welfare reform was actually put together. So just to remind you that the program went from being open-ended to a 60-month lifetime limit, and that the grants in these programs have not been increased since 1986. So these are already fairly lean programs with not any extra money for people to use for other than rent, utilities, food, specific needs. And that was how the welfare reform was done, to try and streamline the administration, hold it to a certain level, so that we wouldn't have to have so much detail. All that detail adds tremendously to the cost of administering the program. I cringe when I hear vendor payment. That is probably one of the most expensive ways that you can control it.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Madam Chair,
yes.
And members
please
of the committee.
State your name for the
My name is
well.
Clark Gustafson. I've been the director of Meeker County Social Services for 26 years and served in La Caparo 7 years before that. I represent the small counties in Meeker County, and I am a member of MACSA, and I'm here on the MSSA conference. The reason I feel strongly about coming here is I have a very limited staff. I have 10 financial workers. Just some statistics, we have 72 MFIP cases. A year ago, it was 86. Meeker County, we used to have like 1,650 financial cases. We're up to 1,800, and it's even actually come down. We have hit all-time highs, and this is going on in a lot of the other counties all over the state because of the economic. Actually, it happened when gas hit $4 and the economy tanked. Well, we lost some major employers like 3M and Hutchinson, which employed a lot of Meeker County folks. So, you know, when you have the 60 months limits, I go, well, okay, maybe we could do with less if times are good, but times haven't been good lately. And the thing is, the vast majority do get off in a year. But again, I just see with only 10 financial workers, I've had not any staff raises in 3 years. I haven't hired any more staff in 3 years. We are extremely limited here, too. And every time these programs has these changes, we got to deal with the computer changes, but we got to deal with the complications. And one of the things that MACSA and AMC and MSSA want is administrative simplification. So I will remind you, for a woman and a child, it's $437, and for two women and a child, it's $500. These are, like Ruth and my colleagues said, this is a very small amount. So I guess in the scheme of things, I think there's bigger and better things that can be worked on. So thank you.
Thanks, Representative Dowell. Thank you very much. We're not going to take a lot of questions now, just we have such a list. Do you have to? Go ahead, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wondered if either of you have quickly any kind of comparison with the benefits in neighboring states that was referred to earlier.
Maybe briefly, and I know it's a long answer, but that's a good question.
Other states structured it a little differently. Wisconsin kept the limit on MFIP lower, but put a lot more money into child care, hoping that people then would be able to work instead. So it's really very difficult to do the apples and apples comparison.
Thank you. Representative Dowell, do you want to make an amendment?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just in having conversations with interested parties here while the testimony's been going on, I think it would be if you would have somebody make the motion to delete, I think it's Section 4, which would get rid of the 100% poverty level exit on the program and leave it at the current 115%.
Representative Liebling wants to make that motion. I think there's a list of people who would want to help with that. So that would move to delete this exit level question. Everybody understand the motion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
That's adopted. Thank you. Now, see, that's what the kind of response the committee just can be. The counties complain. Like a minute later, it's squared away. So please don't testify to that part. Now we have a bunch more people. Mr. Rushy and Mr. Peters, can you come together? Then on deck we have Ms. Webster again. So, and these are two-minute folks. So, and a lot of you have testified over the past on this, but I appreciate your passion and I appreciate your information. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Brian Rushi, Joint Religious Legislative Coalition. I'll take a minute and 50 seconds now that Section 4 is gone. Appreciate that change very much. It was one of my deepest concerns. I still have concerns about the bill, still oppose it. Basically, here are the reasons. Even though the drug conviction is now self-reporting, I think asking every applicant about that unnecessarily criminalizes the program that they're seeking help from. And it's stigmatizing, and I just think that people are already under financial duress. Why are we presuming criminality? I think it's unfortunate to treat everyone to that kind of presumption. I'm really worried about the clock change, the 60 months going to this kind of rolling 12 here and lose 12 there. I worry about the administration from both the state and the county's point of view about how they might keep track of months, especially if people have lived in other states. I think this could be hugely expensive from a Max's standpoint. Don't know that, but very concerned about it. My biggest objection to the bill, though, is I think that we have not coalesced around a proper definition of the problem. And I take members at their word that they're trying to put more integrity into the program, make it more efficient, trying to close loopholes. But I think the larger problem that begs our addressing before we can get to those questions is, why is there a rising number of people in poverty? And what are we seeing in the wage structure? And what are we seeing in terms of job opportunities and training opportunities? I mean, part of the whole idea of MFIP was to lift people out of poverty. And I think this bill fails to do that and instead becomes a poverty maintenance program. Mm-hmm. That's not where Minnesota has been. I think this bill lacks consensus. I think it needs a lot of work. You saw the letter from the Catholic Conference. It basically restates some things I said in my letter to the policy committee. Thanks for the chance to bring them back before you. We oppose the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Rush.
Yep.
And then Ms. Webster's on deck. So. Welcome.
Chair Abler, members of the committee, I basically was at my office late last
night. Tell us your name.
Oh, yes. I'm Mark Peters with Lutheran Coalition for Public Policy in Minnesota. We are a partnership ministry of the six Minnesota synods of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. And this, one of our top priorities is to preserve a viable safety net. And the Lutheran bishops and the Catholic bishops joined in a letter last year that basically reinforced what Brian just said, so I won't repeat that. My concern about this, and I took my testimony, which I had written in last night and hearing today, I'm appreciative that Chair Abler, you've helped give time to help clarify this and, you know, let us know what we're trying to focus on here. But my critique would be this has really been a flurry of blurry, ill-defined bills. And I don't know that they're necessary. I don't see that they are. I don't see the data, clear link to the data that supports them. I likened it, and I woke up the other night thinking about this as I was preparing. I went to Chuck E. Cheese the other night, and this is where my testimony is going. I'll just wrap up with this. I went to Chuck E. Cheese the other night with my youngest son, who's 7, and I just thought, you know, as I woke up, I think he's about the age, about half of the 70%, nearly 70% that are on MFIB, the kids, are in his age group, you know, under 5, but he's a little bit more than that. But one of the games there was this whack-a-mole. And you take a mallet, and these moles pop up, and, you know, it's all about reaction time. You hit the mole there, and it pops up here, and you hit it there, and it pops up there, and you're whacking the mole. And thank you. And that's what this reminds me of. These policies are popping up, and because of the blurriness of them, because they're not ready for prime time, we're spent, rather than, as Brian said, addressing the root causes of poverty and following, say, the bipartisan recommendations of the Legislative Commission to End Poverty and what they listen to those voices. That's what I'd like to be here talking about today. How do we address the root causes of poverty? This is tinkering. Yeah. And so, stop. I get that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Peters. Really appreciate you being here today. The next, Jessica Webster. Okay, Ms. Webster, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid, and I think I can further abbreviate my testimony because I think that you've heard what I've had to say in the past, and you'll hear it from more testifiers today. We're opposed to House File 2080. We're very, very concerned about increasing child poverty and child hunger. As you heard today, everybody who's on this program has children, and what those numbers really look like, 7 out of 10 people getting a
assistance on this program are kids. And so that's where we're standing today. I just wanted to make one kind of technical point. There's been some question raised about what our neighboring states do. And these are really complicated programs, and so it is difficult to do apples to apples. But in our view, every single state around us has a more generous cash benefit than Minnesota. And this notion that we're somehow a magnet because of our cash benefit, it just doesn't ring true. Wisconsin has a $673 cash payment for families, South Dakota a $555 payment. But when you look at South Dakota, North Dakota, Wisconsin, and Iowa, all of their cash payments cover 70 to 90% of someone's rent, whereas in Minnesota, we're only covering about 66% of the average rent. So if we want to have conversations about bringing in things from other states, I'd be happy to have that conversation about bringing Wisconsin's cash benefit or South Dakota's cash benefit to Minnesota, and talking about how that might benefit our program. And just the last thing I'll say is that those of us who work in the anti-poverty community and those of us who've been doing this for a really long time, it's not a nuclear secret anymore as to how to help people get off of assistance, which I think is the goal of probably everyone in this room, and it's education and training. The way that we turn $9 an hour jobs into $17 and $18 an hour jobs is education and training. So if we start kicking people off that are making $9 an hour, I promise you that it brings other costs to the state and to the system that this committee is not contemplating and that the fiscal notes won't contemplate down the road. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Webster. And just to mention, though, Ms. Webster, you know, like we said before, it is a complicated program, and so sometimes you take one piece and compare it to one piece. It doesn't give you the total context, so I just know from my experience that there are different ways things are packaged. So appreciate that insight and your comments. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Our next, just a moment, please. I just want to be sure our next testifier is ready. Ms. Wagoner? Okay. Yes. And then also Alexandra Fitzsimmons? You want to come down to get ready, too, and Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to ask Ms. Webster, while she was still there, whether she knows of any evidence that people are coming to Minnesota, following on the Chair's comments. Are people coming to Minnesota for our welfare programs, as far as you're aware?
Ms. Webster?
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, I am not aware of that, and actually to the opposite. I've actually heard that more people are leaving Minnesota than coming here.
Thank you, Ms. Webster. And my comments had nothing to do, Representative Liebling, with about being a magnet or anything, just the context of benefits that sometimes different states package them together differently. And if you just take one piece and compare it to another state, it doesn't give a full picture. I just want to make sure we had a full picture. Thank you. All right, Ms. Wagoner.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representatives. My name is Catherine Wagoner with the Affirmative Options Coalition. Our member organizations oppose this bill in its entirety. However, I'm going to speak specifically to this expedited sanction piece, just so you're aware of what parents can be sanctioned for. For one thing, parents who are on MFIT must work or volunteer at least 87 hours every month in order to maintain their benefits. There's just no way around that unless there's some medical issues. So parents can be sanctioned for working 86 hours a month instead of 87. They can be sanctioned to forget to by forgetting to fax job search logs into their caseworker, or a caseworker has lost a job log. Missing an appointment, missing a program orientation. This often happens to people who are English language learners. They may not understand the letter that they get to come in, and then they don't come in, then they're sanctioned. That would be the one sanction. Or if they missed an instructor's signature on their school attendance report. So this also reduces, the penalties reduce the CAS assistance each time, and then ultimately close the case. And just wanted to reiterate that expedited sanctions are cuts to kids and based on the mistakes of their parents. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wagoner.
Thank you.
Ms. Fitzsimmons, welcome. And Mr. Kitzberger, are you here? All right, fantastic. Thank you, Ms. Fitzsimmons, for being here today. Please go ahead and be sure you say your name for the tape record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Alexandra Fitzsimmons, and I'm the Legislative Affairs and Advocacy Director of Children's Defense Fund Minnesota, and I will briefly address CDF's concerns with this bill and provide some information on how we believe this bill will impact children, but especially children who are under the age of 5. And to do that, I thought it might be helpful to borrow my 1-year-old little boy's toy today to make our 3 arguments, hoping that I get through all 3 of them. But the first one I want to make draws us to this first part of this multifaceted toy that looks at the gears, and I really want to talk about the importance of early brain development, because as you've already heard from Reverend Peters and also from Ms. Webster, 7 out of 10 MFIP recipients are children, and half of those children, nearly half, are under the age of 5. So when we look at the importance of early brain development, and we know that 90% of a child's brain is developed by the time that they're 5, and we also know that early experiences have the ability to alter the development of a child's brain. And we know that situations and experiences that a child may have in his or her life, such as poverty and different factors associated with poverty, can actually cause an increase in toxic stress, an increase in the hormone cortisol, and actually change the pathways of that developing brain. So parents who we know are already immersed in a daily struggle to provide food, to provide clothing, to provide the support that their child, that they need, the parents who are already struggling with those things, that they may not have the resources, the information, the time to provide an environment that fosters optimal brain development. That being said, infants and toddlers who have little opportunity to explore and experiment in a stimulating environment may have a fragile foundation. So cutting the number of permissible sanctions and cutting the amount of time that a family can be receiving assistance will place significant pressure, will place greater pressure on parents, yes. But what it will do is it will impact the healthy development of children. And I know that I'm almost out of time here, and I didn't get to make the other 2 arguments, but I want to draw your attention to a report that CSNAP did in 2002. And actually, part of the report they did was based here in Minneapolis at Hennepin County Medical Center. What they found in this report was that children who are in families who are sanctioned, infants and toddlers, again, focusing specifically under the age of 3, have approximately 30% higher risk of having past hospitalizations when they visit the emergency room, have a 90% higher risk of being hospitalized at the time of emergency room visit, and have 3 times the risk of being admitted to the hospital at an ER visit, and also approximately a 50% higher risk of being food insecure. I will leave you with this. The 2 other arguments that I wanted to make was one that we really wanted to focus on the name of the MFIP program. It's the Family Investment Program. We want to invest in families. And the last argument, really looking at the interconnectedness of the MFIP program to other areas and looking at how these programs impact education and other areas. Last piece I promise that I'll leave you with is a poster that was at our ECFE class last week. It said that children's needs are best met by parents whose needs are met. So please, please work on this. Please don't put these barriers to families that are going to, in the end, impact children. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And on deck, Kenza Hodge Musa. Mr. Kitzberger, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Kitzberger. I'm the policy director at the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. We're comprised of 150 member organizations throughout the state. We represent those experiencing homelessness, service providers, and local units of government. The coalition advocates for policies to end homelessness and prevent it. The proposed changes to MFIP and House File 2080 would not do either. On behalf of all families with children who lack stable housing in Minnesota, we ask you to consider the impacts before cutting this bare-bones assistance. Parents who turn to MFIP often work low-wage temporary jobs. And standing behind low-wage working parents are their children. As has been mentioned, about 2 out of 3 MFIP enrollees are children. Families with children make up the largest and fastest growing demographic of people experiencing homelessness in Minnesota. On a given night, 3,900 children are homeless in our state. Thousands of children become homeless each year because MFIP assistance does not cover the cost of housing. A family of 3 receives $532 a month. Waiting lists for programs like Section 8 are too long and most simply close. And limiting MFIP eligibility pushes children already living in extreme poverty into more unstable and uncertain circumstances. So if our goal is to help families move to permanent work, policy reforms should be directed at the low-wage job market and not the people in it. The coalition helped the bipartisan legislative commission to end poverty create valuable policy recommendations to help families gain self-sufficiency. We oppose House File 2080 in its current form and would look forward to working together on advancing reforms recommended by the commission. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you very much. And the next testimony is audio, video, I guess. Huh?
Yes, and Mr. Chair, we're just setting up the computer, so if the person behind me wants to go, and we'll keep working on this. Thanks.
So, Mr. Kramer, do you want to come down? And on deck, we have Ms. Dina Chow.
I know. Oh, there we go. Let's put it back.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Steve Kramer. I'm the Executive Director at Project for Pride and Living. PPL provides comprehensive services in housing, employment, and training, education, and human services to help very low-income people become more self-sufficient. We worked for 14,000 people last year, virtually all at or below poverty. 40% were kids, and MFIP services have been part of our mix since the program began in Minnesota. In these thousands of people, we see Minnesotans, adults wanting to do better for their families and themselves. We see kids facing challenges early in life that we'd be smart as a community to invest to help them be successful. When I hear from my staff about Liza, who we'd been working with for her 4.5 years on MFIP, who with her kids was homeless, unemployed, anorexic, and not in treatment for CD or mental health problems, and who has now overcome each of those barriers and is working full-time and studying for a GED, that tells me that drive and motivation is not the issue for these families. I know some people reflexively believe that. That's not what we see. Dr. King said famously, it's a cruel jest to tell a bootless man to lift himself up by the bootstraps. What we see are more and more bootless families without the support they need to succeed. My organization favored welfare reform in the 90s because we saw the downside of programs that made it a wise economic choice to stay on assistance. But as others have said, the bipartisan agreement at that time was to create reforms around alleviation of poverty, creating incentives for work, putting a premium on education, supports to make these steps possible realistically for low-income families. That's what animated welfare reform at that time, created strange political bedfellows and made it a powerful idea, and it worked. That policy direction plus an improving economy meant poverty plummeted during that period of time. But tragically, in recent years, the general direction of change has been less and less about policy to lift families from poverty and more about a pronounced shift towards punitive measures. And since that direction has corresponded with the worst economy in any of our lifetimes, it's no surprise that the gains have been reversed. Poverty is increasing, again, mostly visited upon children. In my view, in our view, from our experience, this bill promotes ideas that run counter to the idea of giving a people hand up that they need to succeed. The consecutive month limit is too short. Liza's 4.5 year journey with us tells me that. And the changes to sanctions, as others have said, are more to catch people and throw them backward than to help them move towards greater self-reliance and escape poverty. I hope you will look to history, to what has really worked for people, and reverse your course. You can reset the argument here in Minnesota nationally, and I hope you will do so. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your good content. Is that ready to go?
Yeah.
And welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Kenzaj Musaf. I'm from the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. We have a two-minute video from MFIP enrollees. We just feel like we can't really talk about MFIP reform without looking at low-wage work in the job market.
Thank you very much.
Can you hear anything?
No. Can your microphone work? The regular microphone?
And I was cooking there. I always got dropped in. It just... I needed a full 40 hours.
They were giving me like 10 hours a week. I'd be scheduled for 20, but they'll send me home early, you know, just cutting my hours. How you gonna eat, how your child's gonna eat, on top of having to be to work at a job that's really not paying nothing. It brought a lot of stress on me. And
recently I applied for unemployment insurance. For 2 weeks I was approved. I have been with a temp agency actually for 3 years.
Okay.
So they used to always keep me with leads, job leads, and you know, I was always on the hot list, so I never had to worry about employment really while I was still looking for permanent employment, just to have some stability. And I had, you know, phone messages, them calling me and telling me that we can't find work this week, but we'll try next week. We'll give you the first lead, you're on the hot list.
Uh-huh.
So when we had the conversation and they told me that I quit that location, I was stunned.
It was daycare doing daycare, self-employment.
Sears, retail, customer service.
I was a server and a administrative assistant.
A construction company.
Temporary service. I just wish whoever, you know, because the guidelines for NFIP, I wish they would, you know, get out there and talk to more people who's on NFIP and get to know their stories, you know, get to see where they can help and how they can help.
Thank you
so much. And it's nice to have another way to look at that, so thank you very much. And so Ms. Chow, and then on deck we have Darnella Wade.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Dina Chu. I'm a housing specialist with Simpson Housing Services in Minneapolis and suburban Hennepin County. At Simpson, we serve both single adults and families experiencing homelessness, and I work specifically with our family housing programs. We do oppose this bill, but I would like to speak specifically about the expedited sanctions, hopefully in different words than were said before. For a family in stable housing with reliable transportation and full-time access to a phone, three strikes and you're out rule does seem fair. However, this is not the reality for many of the families that we serve at Simpson Housing. When you're living in crisis, simple tasks become more difficult. A person who is normally very responsible and organized might start misplacing important information or forgetting appointments. A single parent on a fixed income may have trouble making it to meetings when they don't have reliable, affordable childcare. When a parent who relies on public transportation has to use the little cash assistance that they do receive to pay their portion of rent and utilities, they may have not had the opportunity to save for bus fare to get down to their MFIP appointments. Or maybe they haven't been able to keep up with their phone bill and wouldn't be able to call their employment counselor to let them know they'll be late. When someone is homeless and lacking an address where they can receive mail, they might not get the information they need regarding their MFIP case in the first place. Or if they did somehow get the information, when a parent is dealing with finding new housing, getting their kids transported to school, and making sure everyone has enough to eat, completing their job log might have dropped on their priority list. And no matter what a parent might be dealing with, the assistance that MFIP provides is ultimately to help their children. Making these cuts to MFIP will hurt children more than anyone else. By making these changes, the families that no longer qualify for MFIP are not just going to go away. Those that can no longer receive MFIP will likely end up homeless, sick, or desperate. MFIP is there to help struggling families who already face many barriers. Please do not create even more barriers for struggling families to reach stability and self-sufficiency. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Wade. Okay, and then Angel, if you want to come over, Ms. Buechner, sorry. Welcome to the committee.
Hi, thank you. I am Darnella Wade, and I lived in Minnesota for like 25 plus years, and I had children living here also, and I've been off of MFIP for about 10 years. I only use 60 months. That was 10 years ago. The last 10 years have been hell, really. My first baby father, he's deceased. The second one has been diagnosed with some mental illness. And I'm the head of the household with four children to pull through this war. It's a war on us. I've been off of welfare. I haven't received any cash. Well, I did last year because I They have a category for exemption based on domestic violence. So in my 10 years of starting a relationship, obviously it was the wrong decision, and it led to other things, and it did affect my employment, and they gave me assistance for 12 months, which ended this year, January, because I got out of the relationship. But there's a lot of things that, without support from my government, my extended family, this is what the government is. It is the extended family. You cut off people, families, children, for whatever reason, you will have an influx on crime. You will have an influx on mental illness. You will have an influx on protesting and people that are trying to stand up for their... It is survival. It is. It's easy to sit with a nice, comfortable income and project that I'm not worthy, my kid's not worthy. But I've been employed 10 years. They haven't changed the law. There hasn't been a dollar saved for me and us and our family. And I we're fighting. And I actually would like for you guys to implement a system where we could get back on assistance. Not off forever, because forever leads to what? My oldest is 20. We've been off years infant for 10 years. And my youngest is 14. And we've had many, many, many problems. And because there's no one to talk to. There's no one to help us. There's nothing out here for us. And I also want to add that I've been employed by various, including like trash removal, trying to find jobs. But my last job, personal care attendant, been a PCA for 10 years. And somehow the whacking the mold thing fit. Because they found a way, because I work for a family member, to cut my income of 1.5 come August last year. When you tell the truth about welfare, when we are being given that 60-month time limit, which you want to cut down to 12, we're sanctioned for various reasons. It hurts.
Thank you.
It does. When you're standing there fighting for your kids, and you know for a fact there is no other way. Either you sell your body, or you sell your drugs, you sell your soul, whatever it is. I want you to know that you guys are affecting. You are affecting. You are the tsunami. This is it for us. We can't move to another state. I don't have another country. This is it. You guys have to find a way to stop poor bashing. I don't have it. And what I do have, you come and get. Miss Franson, the food stamps. I only get food stamps. And now I'm categorized as an animal. I don't go to jail.
Miss Wade,
I'm not a felon.
Time is up.
And I don't want you to make me one. That's all I'm saying.
I gave you extra time. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I appreciate it. The next individual, there's three more testifiers left, and they all have a little extra time. If they take all the time they have, there'll be no time for more discussion, and the bill will be held over. So, so maybe if you don't have to use all those minutes, then we could use the time for some more discussion. But you're entitled to 4 minutes if you want it. But I'm going to be strict, and at 4 minutes, you have to stop. Okay? Thank you.
So it starts right now, though, not while you were talking. Okay.
Whatever. Go ahead.
I just want to make sure.
Go ahead, Ms. Buchner.
So my name is Angel Buchner, and I'm with the Welfare Rights Committee. I'm just going to kind of paraphrase, because I know you guys heard it all before, but I just want to make sure you understand. Changing the 5-year time limit to 36 months will absolutely devastate a lot of families. 3 years to 5 years isn't even enough to get people out of poverty, okay? I'm not going to dwell on it. I'm just going to say it's just not enough time. Sanctions was already covered. I won't go into that. But I will talk about the EBT. This is an expensive change to fix a non-existent issue. What is the point of doubling the number of EBT cards that the state has to issue? So you're talking about, you know, giving another EBT card to a non-family member or a family member that has to, go with giving people their food if they can't get it on their own. I just wanted to also just kind of put a personal spin. I'll tell my personal story, okay? you don't hear about that much. But what I've personally took myself off of MFIP because of the stress of trying to keep up with paperwork, trying to maneuver through each hoop to get through everything. And right now, my family only receives food stamps. Okay? We're not, we're just trying to make it like everybody else. And I'm not going to take up a lot of time, but this issue is a very touchy issue for me. And I've born and raised in Minnesota. I lived in St. Paul all my life. I lived in my house for 11 and a half years, and I lost my job after 9/11 happened. The business closed up, and I didn't have anything. I got you.
You're doing great.
And so when we didn't have anything, we were homeless. And when we went homeless, we ended up leaving Minnesota and going to Fargo. And Fargo wasn't a place that I wanted to be. So I decided to come back to the cities. I came back to the cities, and I lived in a shelter. It took me another year to find a place to live. That was relocating all four of my sons to another location, another school, another neighborhood, getting to know other people. In that time, I needed to go and apply for assistance and to get myself back together because I didn't have anything. I used up all of my, time with my, unemployment insurance and the little bit of money that I saved through my job. And I needed to go back and apply for welfare. People don't want to be on welfare. It's not a place where we want to be. I didn't want to be there. I didn't want to be there. I'm just saying, you have to think about things before you pose these types of legislation. And I just wanted to end with, a couple of statements. This kind of mean-spirited assault with these already totally inadequate programs doesn't serve a human purpose. It doesn't even serve a responsible financial purpose. At this time of economic crisis, when thousands, not just the poor, but college grads, recent veterans, and folks with skills are jobless, and the foreclosures and evictions are still happening, this time of economic crisis is not the time to be shredding the safety net and programs people really need. Finally, we should vote no because this bill buys into yet another poor-bashing stereotype, pander to mean-spirited mentality of bullying and hate. I'll end with that.
You had 5 seconds left. Thank you very much. And we have two more testifiers, and we have 7 minutes for two people. And at the end, at 2:15, we're going to lay the bill over and adjourn. And I'm sorry for members who had questions. We won't have time for those anymore, unless the testifiers decide to be shorter. We have Mr. Franco, who has 4 minutes, and then the remainder of the time will go to Ms. Konecki, whatever is left for her.
Hi, my name is Kim DeFranco. I'm with the Welfare Rights Committee. We are here to speak against both bills that are before you. We see that banks and the corporations get bailed out all the time. But since we're still in a continuous economic crisis, people and families with children are being pushed off the economic ladder. These bills do nothing to help the poorest of the poor get a hand up. In fact, it's a beat down on people and families with children who are struggling not only to make ends meet, but are seriously trying to keep their families from going under. Besides being cruel, these bills will cost. You are just wasting taxpayers' monies to come up with more ways to criminalize poor families and denying any kind of help. These bills will hurt all poor and working people in Minnesota. Cutting the poor and homeless families off survival assistance will not help your basic working person. There's a whole sector of unemployed people who are running out of unemployment insurance. Making it harder to qualify for assistance will not help them, and it certainly will not help the economy as a whole. Wages and hours are being cut. Many of us have been forced into debt. Our housing is iffy. Making people's lives unbearable does not help us in the least. Minnesotans, whether in poverty or not, want our kids to go to school next to the kids that actually have a roof over their head and food in their bellies. Actually, what we really need, we don't need, we need jobs. We don't need insults or beatdowns. We need real solutions to get people back on their feet and out of poverty. You should actually end poverty and not welfare. I keep hearing you want solutions. Here's a few to get started. All of you should focus on job creation, jobs that actually pay living wages. Focus on foreclosure, the foreclosure crisis, and keep families in their home.
Mr. Franco, you have 2 minutes just for your
information. Focus on affordable housing, education, health care, and child care. These solutions are real solutions and will be a great step forward to actually ending poverty. And all of you should focus on getting where the money is, the richest people in the state and the corporations. Take it back, tax the rich. The money is out there. The majority of you are refusing to consider even these options. While the poor, working people and families with children are still living through the cuts in years past, there is nothing else to take. You all need to stop. And if you vote for this bill, you should go back to your constituents, which I'm sure many of people are in dire straits, and tell them, no matter what I say about giving a hand up out of poverty, I'm just making your life harder for you and your family and children. So you're on your own.
Thank you.
And that's where I've been for 10 years.
Thank you. Ms. Konechny, there's about 3 minutes left. Did you want to say something, Representative Murphy?
Deb Konechny.
So I can give you only 3 minutes. So.
That's fine. I'm Deb Konechny with the Coalition for a People's Bailout. I just want to start by saying that this bill, as has been said, is a poor-bashing bill that attacks the lifeline for parents, primarily mothers and children, who live deep in poverty. Welfare for families in this state makes up only less than one half of 1% of the federal budget. It is clear that these bills are merely an attempt to gain political points by beating up on poor mothers and children. It is disgusting. We are in the deepest economic crisis since the Great Depression. There are many things that this legislature could do to actually help the people of Minnesota, like jobs, like health care, like doing something about the foreclosure crisis. I was just in a foreclosure moratorium hearing. That bill is not even getting a hearing. So it's an outrage. You have hearings to bash up on poor people, but you won't even allow a hearing to talk about how to deal with the housing crisis and stop these foreclosures that you know are affecting all of your constituents. And I just have to say, too, the attitude that runs beyond or below comments such as was made over a week ago about food stamps and equating people to wild animals, we don't see this as an isolated thing. We see this as a rampant attitude that is running through this Capitol that is okay with demonizing and criminalizing and humiliating the poor. And finally, I just have to say, it's very interesting, this page that was brought up to me personally before I spoke, saying that a person will be guilty of gross misdemeanor who willfully disturbs the legislature. I want to say that it is the legislature that is willfully disturbing the lives of thousands and thousands and thousands of Minnesotans. Or committing disorderly conduct. Do you think it is not committing disorderly conduct when you try and take away the lifeline that we have to keep our kids under a roof and with food on our table? And finally, it talks about intimidation of members in here. I am sorry, but what you are doing is the greatest intimidation that anyone can do. I don't care if you feel intimidated. You are not having your very life being attacked by people who have power that are attacking the public. You're the public servants. You should learn to serve the public that you were put in here to serve. You are not. You are attacking, and that is the intimidation that should be stopped. It's
Thank
a
you.
Crime.
Representative Murphy, do you have a comment? And then Representative Dowd will close, and we'll be done.
Mr. Chair, I do have a comment. I've listened carefully to the testimony, and I've yet to hear a good reason why we should move forward with this legislation. I move to lay it on the table, and I'd like a roll call.
Representative Murphy, it's being held over anyway, so it's not going out. So it's kind of an irrelevant motion. So, yeah.
Mr. Chair, I'll withdraw the roll call, but I move to lay the bill on the table.
Okay. That's a motion. It's a fine motion. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Aye.
I forgot to vote. Aye. Anyway, the ayes have it. The bill's laid on the table, which is interesting ending to an interesting day. Members, I appreciate the thoughtful testimony. And I think that even though the bill is tabled right now, I would suspect that doesn't mean the topic is done for now, but I think it's a valid point to make on the part of the mover. Upson Dowd, do you want to say anything for a point of personal privilege before you leave the committee?
No, thank you. I would, Mr. Chairman. Yeah. I just want to thank everybody for their testimony, and certainly I've appreciated all of the people who have approached me over the last couple of weeks to talk about concerns with the bill and to work on the bill. And I will say, I know there's been a little effort to villainize me as somebody who doesn't really care about these people. I think the people that did come and see me could certainly give you a different story. So I appreciate the people who did come and talk to me, and I would look forward to working with anybody else in the future on this issue.
And members under the audience, I appreciate a very civil discourse on a very difficult topic where everybody has a lot of strong passion on both sides. So with that, we're adjourned.